Okay, good morning, everybody. I'm Antonio Vantaggiato from Sacred Heart University in Puerto Rico. I'm the convener for this session, and it's my honor to introduce the speakers for today. We will have two sessions of 15 minutes each, and followed by a question and answer session. And the first speaker will be Gardner Campbell. So please welcome Gardner Campbell.
Thank you. Thank you all very much for being here this morning. I want to talk today about worrydream.com, which is the website of Brett Victor, who is, I believe, one of the most important thinkers in computational thinking, participatory culture, learning design, the philosophy of learning, computing and learning on the planet today. Largely unknown. I hope we can fix that. Here's one way to start. This is Brett Victor on Twitter. Those of you who have mobile devices with you, please consider, at this time, navigating to Twitter, worrydream.com, and following Brett Victor. If you choose to do that, or even if you don't, if you would do me the courtesy, if you tweet during this session, of @ing Brett Victor, what Twitter now calls mentioning, so that he can see we are having this discussion. I think it would be encouraging to him, perhaps slightly scary. He won't know our tribe the way we do. But I think it will also show an upswell of interest that will be good for the rest of the ELI community to see and all those who have been following the conference. If you go to Google Scholar and you look up Brett Victor, you find links to his presentations and some IEEE work he did around the turn of the century, and that's about it. But if you go into the blogosphere or just out onto the web and you Google Brett Victor, you get about 3 million hits. So you will see that there is quite a gap between his awareness, our awareness of him and his importance among many populations, and what we're doing with his work in higher ed. This is Brett's website. You can see there's a cannon on the left firing him with his saber at the windmill on the right. The circus motif is deliberate. The Don Quixote motif is deliberate. He identifies himself as a purveyor of impossible dreams, and his current CV, in addition to the work he's done with Alesis, with Apple, with engineering societies, now lists his occupation currently as hobo. So when you go there and explore this site, as I encourage you to do, you will begin to see an embarrassment of riches. I'm reminded of Tom Lehrer's joke that when Mozart was his age, he had been dead for 4 years. When you look at what this man has accomplished just in about 37 years, I think you will agree with me that it's some of the most important and tragically unknown work that's out there in fields directly related to what we care most about. When you go down to his talks, which could take you the better part of a sabbatical just on their own basis, you'll see that he has a flair for really interesting titles. This one's called Stop Drawing Dead Fish. And I heard him do this live at Foo Camp in the summer of 2012. I had rushed up to him like the fanboy I was and said, Brett, you're Brett Victor. And he looked down at the ground and then he looked up and he said, I'm glad my work is helpful for you. And then he just stopped talking, smiled shyly. I pressed forward, didn't get his autograph, which I very much regret now. However, told him of some of the work I was doing and that I hoped to make his work more widely known. He was quite appreciative. And that Sunday, 2 days later, I got to be in a group in a very small part of the O'Reilly campus in Sebastopol, California. And we got to watch him do Stop Drawing Dead Fish. Stop Drawing Dead Fish is about enabling, as he continues to try to do, human beings to work with complex abstractions in ways that are as direct, immediate, and visible as the early cave painters were able to do their work on the walls of those caves. Brett Victor is convinced that creators need to be able to see what they're doing. And to get up the ladder of abstraction, Brett Victor's conviction is the learning will only happen effectively if you get immediate and visible feedback. He has another talk called Kill Math, but I won't go there. Let's do some more with Stop Drawing Dead Fish. This was the performance a few months later that was repeated at the Exploratorium and recorded. It's almost impossible to understand what he's doing unless you watch it, so please go do that. But just as a little bit of an overview in the time we have here, I will note that that's Brett in the upper right-hand corner. In the middle part over here on the right, he has two iPads, which make me deeply ashamed for the routine office automation work I do on my iPads, and should give the lie to the old saying that the iPads are only for content consumption. In the hands of an artist, a thinker, a programmer like Brett Victor, those two iPads, the one on the left with the controls, the one on the right that was his animation screen, allowed him to do a real-time, live, animated presentation from the first cell division on the planet to our voyage into interstellar space with music. What you see him doing right there with his right hand is bringing the space shuttle up over the Manhattan skyline, all of those drawings accomplished in real time by the way he's programmed the animation to represent the complex things he's trying to convey, all of which will be visible in much more detail on his website. It is no accident that that particular screen arrangement recalls, at least for me, very strongly, the superimposition of the computer screen, the two-way video conferencing, and the live shot of Doug Engelbart on the stage at the Mother of All Demos in 1968, dealing lightning with both hands, as one observer noted, demonstrating our future of interactive, personal, networked computing. The connection between Brett Victor and Doug Engelbart is very strong. Indeed, Brett Victor, in addition to his work in learning, is deeply connected to a tradition of pioneers, mavericks, many of them largely unknown, who have been working on computer-human symbiosis and the augmentation of human intellect. Brett talks about this work in one of his talks called Inventing on Principle, and these are three intellectual and spiritual progenitors, one of whom has spoken at the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative. How many of you were there when Alan Kay talked to us a few years back? Doug Engelbart, Alan Kay, Richard Stallman. Three people with an insistence on the vast extent of human capability, the vast extent of human responsibility to step up to those possibilities. And this particular talk is one in which Brett talks about his own life, which he says is organized not just around finding and sharing his passion, though he is a very passionate young man. He has organized his life around a principle. And that principle has to do with giving human beings better ways to get their arms and minds around complexity and the complex symbol systems that can express that complexity. And in this talk, he reminds us, as I've already said, so much of creation is discovery. And you can't discover anything if you can't see what you're doing. An invitation to all of us in education to consider anew how much of what we do is invisible, how much of it vanishes, how much of it isn't shared, or in any way contributing to the co-creation of culture and knowledge. This is Brett Victor's research section, which he calls Things I'm Thinking About, aka research. I bring this to your attention because too often in my experience, undergraduates, and occasionally graduates as well, do not consider their research what they're thinking about. They consider their research what they are reporting on. Anybody ever tried to grade a paper in which it's clear that the student has gone to the library to find the source that says whatever he or she needs it to say, and then brought it back in canned, dead, alone, but properly cited, perhaps? MLA, Turabian, Chicago, all those things that matter but maybe not as much as the thinking. Anybody graded a paper like that? Am I just projecting? Okay, all right, good. And a little close-up here brings us even a little closer into the mind of Brett Victor. Tools and techniques for reducing abstraction and indirection, encouraging people to understand and create via exploration and intuition. This is the way in which Brett Victor describes what he calls research. It looks an awful lot like a mission statement for educators. It is, I believe, intimately connected with the future of learning design as we move from ideas of static knowledge preservation to ideas of dynamic knowledge repositories and co-creation, those ideas which have always been hiding in plain sight. Victor reminds us, people think of text as information to be consumed. I want text to be used as an environment to think in. And he has several dazzling displays of what he means by this. This is one of them, an explorable explanation. An essay that's been created with underlined blue bits, which are dynamically changeable by the reader as part of the case being made. So when you're there on the website and you begin to hover over those blue underlines, you can begin to see a slider you can move back and forth, which will actually make different results pop up on the right. An environment to think in, not a textbook, but a place a student can go to work out the logic of an argument. And as Victor so beautifully explains later in his website, the point is not just to gauge whether you agree or disagree. The point is to say, here is a worldview in which the views are consistent. I recognize that and will keep it in my own mind for the connections I will need to make. At one point, he talks about real teaching. And he says it's not about transferring the material, as if knowledge were some sort of mass-produced commodity that ships from Amazon, or we might say is on the learning management system platform. Real teaching is about conveying a way of thinking. And then he asks very pointedly, how can a teacher convey a way of thinking when he doesn't genuinely think that way? I'm sure many teachers spend their evenings thinking about teaching the subject. I have no doubt that these teachers love teaching and love their students, but to me, that seems like a chef who loves cooking but doesn't love food, who has never tasted his own food. This chef might have the best of intentions, but someone in need of a satisfying meal is probably better off elsewhere. And I can tell you in my own educational journey, the moment I knew I had passed from high school to college was the moment I encountered a teacher who didn't simply think about teaching poetry, but thought about poetry, was consumed by it, and was canny and interested enough to be plugged into the ways her students could be interested as well. There's also a section on Brett Victor's website called Links. Now, this doesn't take you to a web page with a link farm. It takes you to more Brett Victor. This is the section on design with a little bit up at the top right I want to draw your attention to. Highly recommended things, he writes. This is my 5-star list. These are my favorite things in all the world. A few of these works have had an extraordinary effect on my life or way of thinking. They get a 6th star. That is, in addition to the implicit 5 stars on everything listed here, there's an extra one to say special plus. And there is a section on education. It's in the section called Society, along with corporatism, progress, media, and history. And you'll notice there is one book there with 2 extra stars, 7 in total. Seymour Papert's Mindstorms. Brett Victor's comment is simply, this is how humans were meant to learn. How many of you have read Mindstorms? How many of you have read The Children's Machine, which is kind of a follow-up to it? So you know that Papert is himself a profound educational thinker. And in that lineage, Brett Victor also channels Maria Montessori. Jean Piaget, Jerome Bruner, and another profound educational theorist, Alan Kay. This is in Brett Victor's report on what he learned in 2013. And there's an astonishing array of things there. And down towards the bottom, here's Alan Kay, four of his recent addresses, and this very interesting chart of human universals and non-universals. Of Kay, Brett Victor says, as you read and watch Alan Kay, try not to think about computational technology, but about a society that is fluent in thinking and debating in the dimensions opened up by the computational medium. Now, I'm going through this quickly as I approach the end of my time, but please linger there in your minds. That's the goal, not how do we make an e-book. The goal is how do we think fluently, debate fluently in the dimensions opened up by the computational medium. Don't think about coding. That's ink and metal type, already obsolete. And don't think about software developers. Medieval scribes only make sense in an illiterate society. Think about modeling phenomena, modeling situations, simulating models, gaining a common sense intuition for nonlinear dynamic processes. Then think about a society in which every educated person does these things in the computational medium as easily and naturally as we today read and write complex logical arguments in the written medium. This is, I think, the farthest ambition and the essential task for what we call computational thinking. And I leave you with a reflection from Brett himself on his own little crisis when he first read Jerome Bruner's Notes Toward a Theory of Instruction, one in which, as I gather, Brett was thinking, but this has all been said before. Why do I keep on saying these things? Alan Kay had some advice for him. Alan Kay writes, Brett Victor shares, I think the trick with knowledge is to acquire it and forget all except the perfume, because it is noisy and sometimes drowns out one's own brain voices. The perfume part is important because it will help find the knowledge again to help get to the destinations the inner urges pick. So I leave you today with the scent of a thinker, a learning theorist, a learning designer, Brett Victor, worrydream.com. Thank you.
A great talk by Garner Campbell. I, for a reason of time, didn't tell you before that Garner is Vice President for Learning, Innovation, and Student Success at Virginia Commonwealth University. So now it's the turn of two people who I'm going to introduce now. Before, while they are going to arrange their computer here, I will tell, please, to evaluate the session after it is completed through the online tool. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Rob Abel, CEO of the IMS Global Learning Consortium, and Jack Seuss, Vice President for Information Technology and CIO at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. So here's Jack and Rob.
Sound check. Is this better? Yeah, okay. All right, we're ready to go. It's a miracle that curiosity survives formal learning. That's a quote from Albert Einstein. I want you to step back for a second and think about the best experience you've ever had in a learning context. Now what I want you to think about is, are we providing the conditions at our universities for that kind of learning to occur on a regular basis? I also want you now to step back. Go back with me to 1998 and think about the learning management system. It was liberating. It was even democratizing. It allowed us, anyone could begin to put content up on the web, make it available on the internet. It was something that really allowed us to move away from the shackles of having to be technical experts in HTML. And we were all excited about the possibilities. You move forward to today. This quote from Dr. Charles Severance at University of Michigan, it's all too applicable to many of our institutions. We are now living in the chains and bounded by many of these systems and what they can do to keep us from innovating. As we think about where we are today in higher education, we know we're in a period of great change. We know that student success, financial pressure, other factors are drawing us in that we're going to have to be thinking differently about the way we educate students. The question that we, Rob and I, want to ask all of you is, do we want vendors to drive that change, or do we as a higher ed community want to drive that change? And if we want to drive that change, we have to be coming up with a vision for how we are going to be moving forward collectively as a community in order to do that. So starting a little over a year ago, Rob and I began talking. I was chair of In Common. I had been involved with the Internet 2 Net Plus activities that are going on. Rob was leading IMS. I could see, and Rob could see, that our work had so many touch points, that if we could be building these systems, thinking about the bigger vision ahead, that we could begin to have benefits that would go much beyond what we were doing individually. And so we met for dinner last January, and what we came out of that was saying is, let's try to begin putting on paper what this conversation is that we're having. We reached out to Malcolm, and what we began doing is coming up with a way of thinking about where we should be evolving. And what we call this vision for a new architecture of learning is really about creating a community. It's about creating a connected learning innovation community. And this community is going to be one that comes together to be thinking about how we can pull this together and move forward.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rob Abel. And I guess the way I would characterize myself is I'm definitely not Brett Victor, but I definitely am a hobo. So, and everybody that knows me knows that. But kind of along the lines of what was talked about in the Brett Victor presentation, it's very important to keep in mind that the future of education is not just about increasing the number of graduates. That's a tall order, and that's very important. But we also need to support diversity in educational models. And one of my favorite scholars is Yang Zhao, because he challenges the conventional wisdom around things like the Common Core and so forth, and I would highly recommend his work. But the question we need to ask ourselves as either IT or academic technology leaders is, what does this mean for us? And to me, what this means is that we need to be put in place an architecture that can support innovative technologies that can support many diverse models of education. And so as a community, we need to think more about what are models for encouraging innovation or architectures for innovation that we can leverage, as an educational community. And one of those models that we certainly know something about is the explosion of apps, or the app model. And the app model is very, very interesting because, in fact, it does promote diversity. It promotes diversity by making it relatively easy for creative individuals to provide products into a ready-made marketplace distribution. But it also helps users, gives them a selection of possible tools to use when and where they may need them, which is, of course, very important to diversity. And many people don't remember, but Steve Jobs actually at first was kind of reticent about opening up the iPhone platform to third-party developers. It was actually in March of 2008 that they announced the SDK for the iPhone. And the number of apps subsequently rose from about 800 in July of that year to a million apps announced in October of this year. And so opening up the platform was a key success factor. The question we should ask ourselves, Jack and I think, here for the education community, is can we open up our collective platform so that we can also accelerate the rate of innovation in education?
So one of the things that we see, this is a poster that we had pulled from EDUCAUSE, where we're talking about the connected age. We can all sort of understand the power that mobile devices have, the power that always-on internet has, but what we don't have today is a real vision for what connected learning is going to mean, for how we're going to implement connected learning. And so the article begins to talk about steps that we can take. Did you hit the slide? This is not the vision. This is Henry Ford's industrial age meets teaching and learning. We have gone to silos to be able to provide stability. We have different groups handling different components of this. In some worlds, we hope that we might have some interchange of information, but rarely is it what we consider a true vision for where we want to be taking connected learning. And that was where we began to come forward with sort of thinking about an architecture. And this architecture is going to be built out over the next couple of years. There's a lot of work that's happening today. There's work around trusted identity that is going to need to be happening in our identity management systems to maintain groups across all sorts of applications that are there. There's ways that we have to think about provisioning dynamically cloud services so that we can immediately bring these things on and off as we go forward. And there's other work that we have to do in making sure that we have open standards that are going to be there so that everyone can be participating, vendors, ourselves, all communities moving forward in this.
So if Apple was able to develop some SDKs to and open those up to third-party developers, can the educational community do the same thing? Well, and what kind of SDKs are we talking about? What kind of interfaces are we talking about? We're not talking about device SDKs because we can't do anything about that. We're talking about the interfaces to the systems that we use inside the educational enterprise, things like portals, learning management platforms, student systems, tools, analytics, stores, and dashboards. And what Jack and I believe is that if we can come up with a common set of interfaces that are cross-supplier, cross-vendor, we can actually establish an architecture for innovation. But how would this be possible? Because don't all these products use different application interfaces? And the answer is they used to until something showed up called LTI, Learning Tools Interoperability. What Learning Tools Operability has been kind of a breakthrough because it's shown that you can indeed establish a single way to interface learning apps and platforms that can be used across platform in a very standardized but yet flexible way. And, you know, we like to talk a lot about disruption in the sector, but we rarely actually see any disruption. LTI is truly a disruption. LTI has shown a savings in time and cost and resources for a wide variety of users in the academic enterprise between 10 and 1,000x. So for application developers, it's write once, run anywhere. For administrators or integration specialists, it's reduced the time to deployment from 6 months to 6 hours, and we think soon to 6 seconds. And for teachers and learners, it's enabled them to put learning resources anywhere they would like inside their learning experience and avoid all the single sign-on hell that they had to go through before. And there are over 20 platforms that can accept LTI apps today. So if you can build an LTI app, you could plug into 20 platforms. And of course, that number is growing, and there are over 100 tools that have been conformance certified applications to work in LTI. And then we have examples such as the University of Queensland. Most of those certified conformance applications I mentioned are from commercial suppliers. But we have institutions, probably some of you in this room, some of which I may know about or not know about, that are really kind of going kind of crazy on LTI. The University of Queensland and John's group have developed over 10 LTI tools that they've integrated into Blackboard using LTI. These are some of the more popular ones. But they've also developed a Drupal framework to make it easy to develop LTI tools. And so we think now is the time to really expand the community and kind of put the control back in the hands of the educational providers and the educational institutions. And the way we're doing this is with a few very, very specific initiatives. One we call the App Challenge, which is an ongoing competition of innovative apps. It's going to occur year after year, but we currently still have open this year till March 1st if you're interested in submitting something. And the whole point of the App Challenge is to encourage and support creation of innovative apps and create that explosion of apps. But, of course, as Jack said, we don't want applications and LMSs to sit in a silo and be unable to be accessed by other types of key information that needs to flow in the enterprise. And so we have a couple of other key projects. One is called Caliper, which is an analytics framework which will make it easy to instrument any application or learning platform to send data anywhere that you would like, and another called CASA, Community App Store Architecture, which is an open source reference implementation for a peer-to-peer network to make it easy for institutions to actually create, share, develop applications in a trusted manner. And so altogether, this is called the Connected Learning Innovation Community, and it's basically creating a new community that can develop apps that are plug-and-play across platform, instrumented for data collection, and also easy to share.
So this slide really shows a founding group that were both vendors and institutions. We came together in early October because we wanted to announce at EDUCAUSE that we were having the App Challenge, and we all put up some money to be able to start this activity around the App Challenge and moving forward. Rob's vision, where he laid out being able to bring forward these applications, the App Store, the real key that I see going forward is also now tying it into some of the other initiatives that we have around cloud computing that is happening within higher ed. If we can have faculty develop great learning applications that they can deliver for free, but then we can launch them on cloud resources so that we can scale these to tens of thousands of active users, this is the way that we can change the way we do things in higher ed and make a difference. And so part of what we hope the Connected Learning Innovation Community is going to be about, it's going to be about stakeholders who want to come together to change the way that we think about tools and objects and the way that we do things going forward. In closing, what we're really hoping that you'll begin to see is this is the article was really the first shot across the bow. This is going to be an active project. What you can count on watching over the next year is in April at the Internet 2 meeting, we're going to be launching activities around what we call trusted identity in education and research. And this is going to be looking at what the identity management components need to be. In May, as Rob has highlighted, you're going to see activities launched around the App Challenge at the IMS Leading Change Initiative. In the summer, you're going to see that the CASA App Store is launched and that we're able to have pilots going forward around that. I'm hoping that by the fall, we'll have the first applications up in some cloud platforms where we can be demonstrating multi-tenancy and scaling this to true tens of thousands. And then hopefully we'll be invited back next year to talk about what the plans are in year two and to get more of you engaged in joining the community that we have. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob and Jack. And now we're going to have a 12-13 minutes session with question and answers. So please, those who have questions, please use the microphone because we are going live with this. So one question that I would like to ask, are the presentation or will they be available online through?
Yes. Where? I don't know. But yes, I
think
usually through the EDUCAUSE website.
Okay, great. Right. Go ahead.
Good morning. I wonder if there's anyone trying to facilitate a discussion amongst the disparate groups that are working on analytics, infrastructure design, application design, and so forth. It seems like there's several different groups that are grabbing a piece of the elephant that no one really has defined. And I imagine that there's probably some overlap in the problem spaces that they're addressing. And so I'm wondering if there's anyone who's trying to precipitate a conversation there across those groups.
Since Sean was looking at me, I'll try to answer that one. Nearly an impossible question to answer as far as I'm aware. I mean, I know there are some various communities that are focusing on analytics. IMS is one of them. And we could definitely benefit from more crosstalk. In IMS specifically, we have chosen to focus on the instrumentation. The instrumentation, that's what I called caliper, of platforms and applications, meaning that we don't care what you want to measure, but we're going to make it easy for you to instrument those apps.
and we're going to make it easy for you to send that data where you want to send it. And we're essentially, just like LTI has made it easy to build cross-platform apps, plug them in, and put innovative things in the hands of end users, we want to make it easy for any app, any platform to be instrumented, and therefore basically there not to be any excuses about not being able to get analytics data. Where analytics data goes from there, there are other organizations and entities and affiliations that are doing a lot more research on what is indeed useful analytics and so forth.
Okay, so Nuj has one quick follow-up. As a specific example, you're talking about defining sort of the semantic structure of events that would go into a learning record store, right? Mm-hmm. And it feels like with Tin Can API, my understanding of that, which is incomplete, is that they're focused on transport of that sort of data.
Yes.
And those seem to be adjacent components of the design.
They are.
And there probably are some overlap there. And so it feels like there's an opportunity to engage that community so that we're not duplicating effort.
Right, right. And we have. We have. Actually, the group that has done the IMS work is very familiar with Tin Can API and has looked at it very closely and knows exactly where they think it would fit in. There's a white paper that talks about it, and we'll just have to see where it goes. We'll just have to see where the market adoption of analytics frameworks goes to really understand what makes the most sense for the suppliers and application developers out there. Very good point.
I would just like to add, though, I think this is where we need to get a community activity, because we also have to think of what are the right questions that we want to ask. And because ultimately that's going to dictate what has to be done early on. And I don't think we've really sort of stepped back and be thinking about exactly what are the questions we want to be answering. And to me, that can drive a lot of the ultimate technical implementation decisions. Next question.
Just from a practical standpoint, what does this mean for those of us who are kind of deeply engaged in looking at new assessment management systems, learning management systems, e-portfolios? What sorts of things should I be keeping in mind while I'm evaluating and leading that charge?
Well, from my perspective as the person that talked about LTI and the standards involved, it's really to ask for products that can support those standards. Because there's a big difference between a product that supports those standards and therefore can be plug and play with other products versus the old model, which essentially is custom programming to do any type of interface.
Yeah, I would just add that at my institution, one of the things that we're doing is leveraging procurement to be thinking about what are the standards. And so we don't buy any software as a service unless it supports Shibboleth and is part of InCommon. We're looking at vendors who are going to be participating more and more in some of the Net Plus kinds of activities, because we want to be forming a partnership around where higher ed is going. And so those are some of the pieces. But I think for some of these also, you know, LTI is a great spec. And actually, you should say LTI 2. Because that really is the newest standard, and knowing what their path is going to be for supporting that would be the way to go. Next question.
So I have to say, this feels a bit like a chimera session, and I'm hoping that maybe starting with Gardner, because you haven't gotten any questions yet, what's the bridge here? I can make my own inferences, but what do you guys think is the bridge between the two parts?
So a chimera is a fabled beast that's part one thing, part another, and they don't really go together. Speaking to you today as a Capricorn, my personal is the goat and the fish, meaning I'm equally stubborn and slippery. What are your inferences? While you're considering that question, I guess if I had to find a bridge, because I agree with you, there is an interesting opportunity for bridging here, spoken like an administrator. I would say that we have equal activity going on from within higher ed and without higher ed to try to figure out what kind of learning environment is most adaptable, most agile, most responsive to the need, as one of the early books said, which is now in my iPhone, so I'll be reading it hopefully on the plane if it's downloadable. Creating world-class learners, supporting creativity in learning. I think both of these efforts are aimed substantially at creativity. And I'll just say in passing that one of the bridges I found in recent experience was a talk by the woman who leads the MacArthur Fellows Program. She was speaking at the AACNU meeting just a couple of weeks ago, and she talked about the Academy as being so focused on critical thinking that it seems to have neglected creative thinking, and that by the measures we have, that's what's most endangered, that's what's declining in longitudinal assessments across student populations. I think that both of our talks today are aimed at restoring creative possibilities for the kind of learning we want to be able to support for ourselves as professionals and for the students we serve. I think we're coming at it from two different directions. And if I could add another silo to that great slide that has silos in it, there's a great big old silo called what they're doing outside the academy that we could learn a lot from. And by that, I do not mean proprietary providers. I'm talking about the larger conversation about the nature and the future of the World Wide Web. I think there's a great conversation to engage with there.
I would just add that I really resonated with what Gardner was saying. I think it will be difficult to achieve what Gardner is highlighting unless we're coming together as a community to be able to create these kinds of things. You're not going to be able to do it at each and every faculty member at each and every campus. We're going to have to be able to create shared ways of being able to take things and scale them across higher education en masse if we're going to be successful in really moving things forward at a rapid rate. And that's where I think these things come together and are linked.
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, people see kind of common interfaces as being something that locks you down. In fact, that's just the opposite of the truth if they're done the right way. Look at the World Wide Web, for instance, which is based on standards. And, you know, the principle behind what we're trying to do with the architecture we're talking about is really to make it easy for creators of innovative solutions, ideas, resources, whatever they are, to put those in the hands of the potential users. That's the principle that we're operating from. We don't know, you know, drawing dead fish, people can do that if they want. But part of Brett Victor's work is all about finding the right tool for the job and putting the right tool in the hands. And that's one of his criticisms of a lot of the technology today is they're just not the right tool. They're just not the right tool. And the point is, if it takes 6 months from the time you select a tool to put it in the hands of all your users, and then it takes another 2 years to find out that that really wasn't what you needed, that's not a good model for innovation. A better model for innovation is to be able to try something out, iterate on that, and, you know, expand that universe, and that's what we're trying to do.
Hi. So I was feel like I wanted to talk about creating apps, essentially. And so I don't quite understand what CASA is. And you talk about it as an architecture and a framework. So wouldn't that be limiting yet again in terms of won't we be bounded, as you talked about, by the technology there? I mean, I wonder if mobile apps aren't better, you know, that iterative and quick creation process is better leveraged by using browser technology and web technology. So is CASA a framework for writing, like an SDK? I mean, I speak personally because we're creating a mobile app using the iOS.
Yes.
And it's a silo. I knew it was a silo when we started, and I didn't want to do it, but that's what we did.
Do you want to answer or do you want me to say?
Well, I mean that's really a question for the technical folks that are actually building CASA, who are led by a bunch of set of universities, UCLA.
But CASA is not a mobile framework.
Yeah, it's not a mobile
framework. So CASA is really thinking about the web. And these are all web apps. But what CASA is thinking about is how can you have a distributed app store? And what you'll have is the ability to be able to trust this. So you might have a system that is going to have an app store. You may have vendors that will have app stores. You may have other groups that will have app stores. And the idea is that these applications, though, will be written to the spec of LTI and be able to be easily brought in, enabled. But because they'll be web-based, you're not having to install software on a local system. They'll be able to be used through the cloud to be able to enable activities very quickly and fluently, hopefully in minutes or hours, as opposed to days, weeks, months that we have today.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I know we're at time.
I think we are out of time, and I would like to thank our speakers very much, and please give them a big applause for their insights and the idea they sparkled. And I wish everybody a very good day. Please evaluate the session, and that's it. Thank you very much.